Hello, welcome back to Making It Real, a podcast by TKS that follows our alumni all around the world. I'm your host, Isabella, from the 2018 Toronto cohort, and I am so excited to share these conversations, the insights, the tech, the problems that we talk about. So without further ado, let's go make it real. Hi, everyone. Welcome back to this TKS podcast. I'm super excited because I'm talking to my friend Alishba. Alishba and I were in the same TKS cohort back in 2018, and we actually did the, Wealth Simple Challenge together. And then since then, we've kind of been friends and working on so many different projects that were very iconic, like prompt patents, which was this like legal AI speeding process in Activate and Google Sidewalk Labs and Kidoko. And I'm so excited to have her on here and just chat with her. So Alishba, why don't you give a little bit of an introduction to yourself and where you are and all the cool things you're up to?
Yeah, I'm so excited to chat. We did something very similar like 5 years ago, so it's fun to be able to catch up and chat about things again. But yeah, I'd say in quick intro just about myself. Right now I'm a student at Berkeley, but a lot of my interests are using machine learning and robotics for solving problems in material science to help with development of new batteries and renewable energy. So before coming to college, I was on a gap year. I was working on my own company, and we were using basically building software to help accelerate the lab to commercialization process for batteries and speeding that up significantly so that we can produce more batteries and use them for grid storage or renewables. And then currently I'm doing research at Berkeley's AI Research Lab. So a lot of my current research is focused on large language models and computer vision. I'm happy to talk a little bit more about that. But also this summer, I'll be going to Tesla. So I'll be doing more applied work on their machine learning battery team. So a lot of the work that I was doing with my previous company using basically computational models to help accelerate development of batteries and develop new materials that we can then use to validate new materials for batteries and hopefully be able to build better battery cells for EVs. So really excited about that as well. But yeah, that's a quick intro.
So it's really amazing because it's like when we started a couple of years ago, we were both just very interested people. It was kind of like, okay, whatever we're doing, let's do it well. And I think we both took that mindset. And I think that's kind of where we align. It's like, okay, we have an opportunity. How do we maximize that opportunity? And it's so cool to see you at that intersection of always maximizing the opportunity. But as time has gone on, you kind of specified into what you're really interested in. And I know when we did our Activate sort of capstone projects, yours actually spun out into the company using, supercapacitor cells and machine learning to identify them. And so I think it's really amazing to just reflect back and just see you develop all these really important projects in the space. It's really cool to be a bystander. And that's what I really love about friendship with people who are just so amazing. We're kind of pursuing different fields, so it's not competitive. Obviously, I want you to succeed. And even if we were in the same field, like I would still want you to succeed because I know how hard you've worked and where you've come from. So anyway, that's like a total side note. But tell me about Tesla. So you're going to be in San Francisco. What does the team look like? Are you the only intern? What is that project? And what are you really looking to take away from that summer?
Yeah, for sure. So the summer, I will be in the Bay Area. They just recently opened up a new engineering headquarters in Palo Alto. So I'm excited to be there. A lot of the machine learning team is in Palo Alto. And then we also have a team in Fremont, which is where the physical lab space is. So they do a lot of the actual battery development and manufacturing in those factories. So I really want to spend time not just doing the computational software side, but also getting exposure to the hardware, hopefully being in the lab where I can see some of the testing and the manufacturing, what really goes into that when they're all the way from like R&D to raw materials and then production when they're putting those battery packs together. But yeah, I think for me, the biggest thing that I really want to learn is just what does it look like to work in a large scale manufacturing facility where you have tons and tons of data? And that's what really excited me about Tesla is just they're obviously huge in EV. And one of the reasons is they've spent, you know, so many years working on this tech already that they've collected a ton of data. And that's when a lot of the interesting stuff happens. When you have the infrastructure built, you have the data, you can start to then build models and do predictions on top of that. So I'm excited about that. The team is very interdisciplinary. We have, you know, battery scientists, people who are very much just scientists, like working on the wet lab side, on the material science side, all the way to data engineers that are more focused on just collecting the data, building the pipelines to connect to the factories and really streamline those pipelines. And then you have people that are more on the predictive side, so building like statistical models or data-driven models, thinking about how we can implement deep learning into some of the work we're doing for like R&D validation, or for you even validate materials, you have to synthesize those materials. or even like battery testing. So I think it's very aligned with a lot of the interests that I had when I was working on my company as well. But I think the key difference is really just being in an area where there's already really people that are very well established and have spent years and decades in the industry. So I'd say the biggest thing is really just getting mentorship and spending time learning best practices from them and seeing from the inside what the industry is really like. Because when we were building our company, it felt like we were outsiders, right? I hadn't spent like decades in batteries or machine learning, but I saw this unique intersection where I had some skill sets I was able to pick up quickly on. But I think learning from people who have spent years, there's a lot of value in that. I think that can be kind of underrated, especially when you're young and there's this push to just go out there and start building as soon as possible.
Yeah, it's interesting because there's kind of this seesaw between, okay, do I start my own thing or do I do something within an organization that has resources? It has incumbency within a field, it has experts, it has motivation because you're within an existing network, but you also have less autonomy because there's someone you're reporting to. And I think that stuff that's so cutting edge that you pioneered, it was really helpful to probably start a company and end it and then go to university because you got such a strong exposure and that probably made you such an interesting applicant when you went to Tesla and you kind of got to a point where you were against a wall or at least at a crossroads, it seems like, and now you kind of find that optimal path. And so I would love to go through your thought process now that you're kind of at a stage where you're working under some really smart people in this field. But before you got to this point where you ran your head against a really hard problem. And as you said, as an outsider. So I'm curious if you would do anything differently in that process and also how you want to translate these two experiences in the future. Like, do you see yourself starting another company? When do you think you'll be ready? Just tell me, walk me through the past, present, and future of this thought process.
Yeah, definitely. I think I've learned through just working on my own company and experiences with past internships as well. I really do enjoy working on my own company. As you said, there's a lot of agency, but I think it's really just a matter of, it's a great way to scale impact and scale what you're working on to kind of a greater audience and feel like you're really doing something to make a dent in an industry. So I really enjoy that aspect of working on my own company, but I think it really just comes back to the value of spending time learning and building skills, especially when you're young. I think that can be, again, underrated just because there's a huge push, especially in Silicon Valley and the Bay Area, which is where I'd say I spend like most of my time. A lot of these thoughts are very much just kind of echo chambers sometimes of you should just go out there and start building a company. But I think there is a balance that you need to strike between going out there, not spending too much time pondering on an idea or spending time building skills, but also spending time doing that, right? Like spending time learning best practices from people who have been in the industry so you can avoid making the same mistakes that they've made and get that very hands-on mentorship. So that's really the stage that I'm at. And that was my thought process when I came into college, really just over-indexing on building technical skills. Like I'd say that's my number one goal alongside meeting cool people, being in this environment. I think college is one of the only kind of environments where you're around thousands of other kids that are doing cool, interesting things that you could just learn from or just have very unique stories and backgrounds that you can learn from. So I think those are like probably my two goals, at least for the next few years. And then from there, I'll gauge if I feel like I'm ready and I have a really interesting problem and idea, I would definitely jump into it. But I think it also comes down to what is the idea? Like the framework that I think of is what is the problem I'm excited about? And then what is the best avenue to solve that problem? And that could be working on a company, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's just joining an existing early stage company that has the right vision, they have a good standing and competitive edge already. So let's just join them and let me just put all my effort to helping them versus starting and reinventing the wheel completely. So I really think it depends and it just comes down to what is that idea and problem that you find really exciting. So I spent a lot of time doing that. And I think that's probably part of my goals the next few years is really to identify what are those areas that I'm just really excited about working on, whether it be in batteries or just machine learning broadly that I want to contribute to.
Yeah, and I think it's a really smart way of looking at it because you avoid any vanity that comes with you raise a bunch of money and then that kind of becomes your personality rather than actually using that to solve the problem. And I think this happens to the best of all people. Like they have all these great intentions, but then when you have a lot of fame, you have a lot of eyeballs and a lot of resources, you kind of appear successful before you are. It's like celebrating before you actually do something. And I think having that framework and like really being integral about it seems like a really good path towards actually doing work in the world. Whereas I think a lot of people think that they're doing work in the world and even in the workplace. I think through secondhand experiences, I've heard a lot of stories about people and companies and it's kind of just this cycle of pretending to do work and it's always pushing back the meetings and pushing back the deadlines and, you know, something will happen and it's always less than the vision that actually delivers. And I think that's integrity is a really hard thing to achieve in this world. But I want to go back to what you said about the college and the opportunity of being at university and having thousands of kids at the same time. I think you come from a very, very, very sophisticated and successful background. And I know at least one thing I found in university is that because we kind of have this outsider, let's just go do things in the world mindset, it does differ, at least for me at UNC. Like, it's very different than what a lot of people think. And so even though there's a lot of different people from walks of life, but sometimes I still struggle to relate on this like conceptual basis. I imagine it's a little bit different from you being sort of so proximal to the Bay Area, but tell me a little bit about this meeting people, what you kind of learned, and then how have you changed as a person to sort of reflect your environment?
Yeah, for sure. I think there's been a lot of reflections in that area. I think especially as a freshman, sometimes if you don't feel like you're a freshman, just because your level of thinking or just introspection is different, and that's totally fine. I think it's just you've spent more time reflecting on things than maybe other freshmen have. But yeah, I think being close to the Bay Area definitely helps. I do feel like I'd find a lot of people, especially with CS or EECS, just very interested in similar areas of research or want to start companies. Maybe they haven't in the past, but are generally interested in that. So I think a lot of it is just kind of a product of your environment. So that helps. I do feel like I've found a close-knit kind of community of people that I can relate to at that level that are interested in similar things. But I still think most people want to have a comfortable job or want to optimize for like being in a job where they can just make a lot of money and live a comfortable life. And that's totally fine. I think that's where perspective really changed. I think coming into college, I very much was like, you have to think the way that I think or you're just wrong. Like, you have to want to do these things. You have to want to work on big things and make big impacts. But I think not everybody wants that. And that's been a huge realization, is people are happy just taking a different path. And that's been a huge realization for me, is that's totally okay. Yeah. So spending time learning from people and even just asking them, like, why are you interested in this? That's the standpoint that I always take, is just instead of pushing back and being like, you should be doing this instead, it's just, I'm curious, tell me more about why you think this way, why you're interested in this viewpoint or these types of things. And I think that helps a lot, because it's less of a pushy perspective of here's what I think and you should do this, and more of just, I'm open-minded and I want to learn. I think that has helped me grow a lot too. I feel like I have gotten different perspectives from people. Also, it's so interesting, because a lot of kids grew up in the Bay Area, so their parents, you know, work at like Google or Facebook, and it's just so different than, you know, the environment that we had in Toronto, where like our parents weren't in tech or didn't start companies before. So I think that perspective is also interesting to think about in terms of how it shaped the things that they want to do.
Yeah, I think there's two things there. One, when you start to feel comfortable with what you're doing, you become less judgmental about what everyone else is doing, because you don't need to validate your decisions by other people doing them. If anything, I've sort of realized that it's almost good that now everyone does the path I'm going, because at least you and I have benefited from being the first, taking an innovative approach, like these different things of thinking differently. Because if we did the same thing that everyone else did, there wouldn't be opportunities to start the company, or there wouldn't be opportunities to really change the way something exists, because then you would just be doing it the way it was done before. So I think that's one realization. The second is just, once you feel comfortable with who you are as a person, or more comfortable, then it's like, well, it doesn't matter that I don't necessarily want to have the six-figure bank job. That doesn't matter to me, but other people do. And like, where do they come from? Why do they think that way? And then treating them with value, remembering that each person has something to offer, but you can't expect what they have to offer. I think what you're doing is really smart, in that you're saying, okay, there's people who think similar to me and I could start companies with them in the future. And so I'm going to befriend them on that premise. But there's also going to be people who want to go work at JP Morgan for their entire life, but they're incredibly funny people and they might be really good to have around when you're having a really hard day, when you just want to watch a mindless movie because you just want to watch something and you get your mind off of something. It's like, okay, sure, it's not like an intellectual, it's not a documentary, it's not a satire, but it's something that completes that purpose. And I think realizing that there's people that have value in different ways really opens you up to the world. I don't know if you have go ahead, if you have any backlash comments.
Yeah. No, I think that last point is super important. I think it's just realizing that there's so many different aspects of a person that make them who they are. And you can be friends with someone for different kind of reasons in terms of just what they bring to your life. And it could just be you just really enjoy being around that person. They're really fun. They're just a kind person. I think that's okay as well. You know, it sounds kind of crazy when you think about it, because it's like, isn't that the way it's supposed to be? But I feel like a lot of people come in with these misconceptions. into college and they only want to be friends with people that are very similar to them. And that's something I almost try to avoid also, because I feel like something I naturally am very comfortable with is being around people that are hyper-focused and think similar to me. But sometimes I feel like I just need to hang out with different people because it's just going to broaden my perspective. And again, I think college is one of those environments where you can really do that. And so if you want to take full advantage, I think just putting yourself in different situations and environments that might be unfamiliar is also a good way to just learn from that.
Yeah. So I want to know what the number one way you think you've changed this year from like a soft skills perspective. I know you've gotten tons and tons and tons of technical competency, but what would you say is your top shift in personality?
Personality, probably just like being more open to things. I feel like before coming, and this is like, I guess, along a similar line of thinking to what I was talking about before, but I feel like I did have a very like rigid perspective on the way I thought, the way I wanted people around me to be, and the types of people I wanted to surround myself with, or the environment that I wanted to be in. And I think I still have that. I have a very strong viewpoint of how I want to live my life, but I've become much more open-minded and open to new experiences and meeting new types of people. It's just very spontaneous. I think the first week of college when I was here, it was really fun because I would just meet random people and I'd just be like, you know what, do you want to go on a hike together? Or do you want to grab dinner together? Just being very open to doing different things. So I think that's been probably the biggest aspect, meeting new people, learning from them, but also just letting loose and being open to not really always having like a rigid framework for how I think about things. Because sometimes it's okay to meet someone new or different or do something that's not planned. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Do you have anything that you're excited to do in the next couple of weeks that maybe complements that new open-mindedness, or the next few months could be as well?
Next few months. Yeah, I think definitely I want to just travel more. I'm still like figuring out my travel plans, but before my internship starts, I want to just take a trip, travel to a new place outside of North America. I think I've spent a lot of my time in North America, probably somewhere in like Asia or Europe. Mm. But yeah, I'd say like traveling is a big one.
Yeah. And do you want to go on a solo trip? Do you want to take a friend? How do you think about creating a really meaningful travel experience?
Yeah, I mean, I'd love to hear from you about that because I feel like you're the queen of traveling. But yeah, I think for me, I enjoy going with friends because I think it's a nice way to build memories. But I also think there's value in solo trips. I don't think I've fully ever done a solo trip unless it's been a work trip. So that could be interesting. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm far from the queen of travel, but I definitely am not a stranger to solo trips. It's such an empowering community, especially solo woman traveler. And I was kind of doing like really physical things, which I've really loved lately, because it's like, I want to climb the mountain. I want to do the hike. I want to like wake up and do the yoga. Like, I want to just do the things because I know I'm capable. Like, I don't want to sit here and pretend that I can't climb a mountain or do this like rock climbing thing because I'm a woman. Like, I don't want to like sit down and have that mindset. And people should be comfortable doing whatever, but like, I know that I'm capable. I might not be the fastest, I might not be the strongest, but like, I can still do it. I save up my money to like do these things because I think it's so valuable for my confidence. And also, I found it really, really, really helpful for like my awareness. Like going to a place that is, it's not North America. Like when I was in Bali, it wasn't North America. Or when I was in Vietnam, like it wasn't North America. You do have to be cognizant of like your phone and like where you put it. And I also think that's such an important thing to be as well, not just to, I don't know, live your life comparing to people in your little bubble. Like North America is such a bubble. So is Europe, at least some areas. I find it so empowering just to go to these places and choose what you want to choose and meet. Like, I met so many female solo travelers, people who were like, they just broke up with their boyfriend and they want to tell a new experience, or they are in a career change, or they just want to become a yoga instructor. And like, people just making empowered decisions for themselves. And then it's like, most people are not into tech or into like healthcare, or into all these things that we are into, but they have like a passion for life that I think is really applicable to what I want to do in the world. And it's kind of like seeing between the lines of what these people are. And so if you can, like, I highly recommend, especially Asia, I've really enjoyed, because it's off the beaten track of Europe, but it still has really good infrastructure. So I think it's been really, really fun. It's like a travel bug. You start doing it and then you just constantly want to do more. Like, I cannot sit in place for like a week now because I'm just, well, if I'm in Singapore, like flight to Manila is only $200, and then it's pretty cheap to live there. And so this is kind of like tangential to something I really want to ask you about, which is the value of humans in this world of AI, the value of humanity, and how that's going to change in the next couple of years. So I'm curious from your sort of interpretations of the industry right now, ChatGPT, and how that's sort of changing things, but also like what you think humans, like, what is my human intuition going to be worth in 10, 15 years?
So, yeah, I think that's a big question that a lot of people are thinking about, especially given the stuff with ChatGPT-3 and just AI in general. It's obviously moving towards like a very fast-paced environment. I think from a technical perspective, a lot of the underlying innovations, like if you think about language models, most of, like, I'd say the architecture has been around for a while, but I think the biggest change that's really happened is one, compute. We just have so much more compute now. And then also just large scale data sets. The reason why language models and CV are doing so well is just because they're trained on large scale internet data. And so it's always so crazy to me when people are like so shocked that ChatGPT-3 is so good, because it's literally trained to give you the answers that you want. It's trained on the internet data.
Yeah.
And so I think that's interesting to me in terms of just like a lot of the hype happening right now. I do think it's really just a byproduct of kind of scaling laws of how technology works with compute and data. But I think in terms of implications, it's an interesting use case because it's the first time I think the average person has really interfaced and seen the impact of AI. So it's an exciting application. And I think we're going to start to see language models be used in a lot more low-hanging fruit tasks to automate things that we spent a lot of time on, but now we don't need to do that. And so I do think there's still value in humans and what we and the knowledge that we have. I don't think these models will be able to fully replace doing complex tasks that humans are able to do, but I think there's still so much value that's unlocked from even just the low-hanging fruit tasks that people used to do that ChatGPT-3 is able to do now. Like, I know so many kids that are using ChatGPT-3 to write their essays right now, which I don't know if that's a good or bad thing, but like, we're starting to really see those things emerge. And so I do wonder how that's also going to change the interface of work, right? What things will we not need to do anymore?
It's so interesting to hear people use this to write their essays, because, like, I mean, I've been writing a blog for so many years, and I'm very particular with the way I write. I delete like half of the words, and obviously, like, I hopped on the trend. I tried ChatGPT. If I asked for like three paragraphs, I at maximum would use a sentence and tweak it. Like, it's so interesting that people like use it to write its essays, because, like, at least at my standard, I'm like, you have to like really add in prompts to like change the style and all these things. Yeah. And at that point, I'm like, I'd rather just write this myself. And I think it's because I put in the work, and like, just like you, I don't know, like, we put in the work to develop your style and to have all these reflections. And part of the writing process, I write stuff and then I'll put it on my Medium page, but the value is for me. Like, the value was sitting down, distilling everything, putting it into a structure, and now I understand it deeply. Someone might read it and they'll gain a fraction of that understanding, but the value was my creative process to do so. But have you seen the picture of like the GPT-3 data and the GPT-4 data? Comparison. It is just so much more. I don't know if you've used the new one, but it is, I think I really liked that picture because it's like, wow, it's something that really puts it into perspective.
Yeah, it's definitely way more powerful. I think it's interesting. In terms of writing, I totally agree. I don't think that's going to be replaced completely by ChatGPT-3.
Yeah.
Just because, like you said, I think a lot of the value does come from the fact that you're spending time just like struggling. And I think that I was talking to someone about this too, in terms of how can we use these tools in education and the way we teach. And it's really just retrieval of information. That's the part that you're making easier, because right now we're spending so long searching the internet. So I really think of it as a smart search engine, just giving you the information with a higher accuracy and much faster. Then the connection of information and putting the things together and getting the insights that you need to be able to do something or write something, I feel like is what humans are really good at. That's the piece that I think will be harder to like replicate in these models.
So I have a professor in a molecular genetics class, and he's been integrating a ChatGPT into a lot of the topics. And what's interesting is we're talking about, I don't know, histone modifications, and he'll go in and ask ChatGPT kind of like the exam like questions. And ChatGPT takes 5 tries to get the information accurately. And it's kind of like, oh, sorry for the confusion. Like, actually, it's this, like, blah, blah, blah. He's kind of been integrating it into the lectures because it's sort of like the Socratic method, but with the AI interface. But also it's like, it shows that the data, it's not perfect. It's like the very human way of always being correct. And at least that's the interface that I'm experiencing. It's very cognitively dissonant in that you put in a prompt and it's like, it says it with certainty. And then it like, it'll sort of be like, oh yes, sorry. Like that was, you know, that I made a couple of errors, but like this time it's actually correct. I did it for a math problem recently and I was like, none of these answers are correct. But it has this human way of like always being right, but like still adapting as you go, which is really interesting to see.
Yeah, definitely. I do think a lot of it is prompt engineering. I mean, this is something that, like, I don't know if you follow, like, Andre Kaparthy. He's former engineering head at Tesla, and now he's back at OpenAI. But he was basically just talking about, like, the next wave of creative AI and developer tools is really prompt engineering. And I was like, I don't know how I feel about that, but there's real companies that are hiring for, like, prompt engineers now, because I do think that's a lot of what it comes down to.
Well, do you think it's overhyped? Because, like, you go on Twitter now and it's, here's the 5 ways you can leverage ChatGPT to become a $10 million revenue e-commerce, fast-growing, multi-consumer goods company. Like, does it feel a little bit like what Web3 was June of last year? Or do you think, I'm curious what you think trend-wise.
I mean, I think it's interesting. It's not something that excites me so much that I would work on it as a problem, right? I think there's, it is an interesting field because, like I said, it's probably the most, like, real interface of kind of interactions with the average user, right? Like, my dad knows about ChatGPT-3 now, which is like, yeah, that's how you know it's really everyone knows about it. But that's why on an impact scale, I think it's really useful. But I do feel like there's just more interesting applications. Like, how can we use language models in biology or vitriol science and scientific fields to help accelerate, like, scientific discovery? So I think there's a lot of, like, untapped potential kind of at the intersection of those fields. Like, how can we use this paradigm of these foundational models? Because we know these foundational models work very well when you have just a lot of data and a lot of compute. Is there a way we can leverage some of the learnings that we have in these other fields to other adjacent fields that are more at the intersection of bio or, like, material science?
Yeah.
So personally for me, I feel like that's what's really interesting. And those are, like, a lot of the newer opportunities that are starting to come up in these fields. Like, very interconnected. We need people to be working on these language models to be able to even apply them to different fields. Sure. So I do feel like it's still very useful work, but I do think there's a lot of kind of untapped potential that people are starting to work on. But yeah, my lab right now, the project we were working on was more focused on using language models for semantic scene understanding. Like, most kind of environments are semantically organized, so you have objects placed next to each other. And language models already are very good at encoding that semantic understanding. And so the goal is really, can we leverage that to be able to feed into this policy that we're using to, let's say, train a physical agent, like a robot, to do tasks in an environment, but make it much easier and much faster because now it has the semantic understanding of its environment, just like humans would have, right? Like, if you have a shelf and you have books placed next to pencils, you know that those are semantically organized. So the books you're looking for will be near the books. That's kind of the idea, is to be able to infuse that into more physical tasks and robots to be able to make those tasks easier.
Okay, I'm curious if there's an intersection between the lab work that you're doing and Tesla this summer. Like, do you think there's going to be sort of a unique value add you can provide?
Yeah, so a lot of the research right now is more ML side, applied to doing more physical automation tasks. But I think a lot of that is very useful in material science as well. There's a lot of research being done in autonomous labs, so being able to do kind of closed loop experiments and validation of materials. Just because right now the search space for finding materials is just so large. And a lot of it is, there's inverse materials design, which is like, you know the properties you want to figure out what's the best design to get those properties. And then there's also just kind of the validation of the materials. Once you've selected the materials, you want to be able to carry out physical experiments to validate them. And there's a lot of work being done in that space to be able to use robots or just like ML models and data-driven approaches to do that validation. So I think that will be very interesting. I'm not sure if they're thinking about using language models in any way. I don't think there's really like a super clear intersection, but definitely a lot of work with just kind of data-driven approaches in general, because there is so much data that we can use to train models and then do more predictive work on, you know, synthesizing the materials or doing property prediction rather than having to do the full manual tests.
Yeah, I think it's exactly what you said earlier. It's all interconnected. One level of development kind of influences the next. And it seems like that's what you're describing. So, okay, this is something that I've kind of been talking to a couple of people about, which is physical spaces. And I think it's interesting because you're kind of working on turning how we organize physical spaces and coding it for machines, letting that become sort of an element to understand physical automation. But what about personal reflections on how you organize physical spaces where you work? how physical spaces influence your productivity, your happiness, all these things. This is a reflection I feel like a lot of people have been having recently, but I'm curious if that's kind of been like a little philosophical light bulb from your work in the lab.
Totally. Yeah, that's definitely been something I've thought a lot about. I guess in general with my work, I'm always optimizing for the environment that I'm in. I think for me, I like to change up my work environment a lot. So I think I like to be around different people and different environments. But I do think the types of people you're around, or even just the way the physical space is organized, affects like your productivity a lot. So for example, I don't like working just in my room because I feel like I'm not as productive. Whereas if I'm in a cafe or even just like a library, I'm around people, that helps a lot because I see other people working. I feel like it's like a better motivator to like get work done. But I think like physical spaces literally matter a lot in terms of just like who's around you, what's the proximity to people you know or people you don't know, and also just the types of environments. I think cafes are like a great example of that. They do such a good job of creating a great ambiance where it's still noisy, but it's this perfect amount of noisy where you're able to just totally zone out and go into this focus mode. So I love cafes personally. I think office spaces are good too. Obviously, fan of WeWork. But I think lately I've been leaning less towards less corporate spaces and more homey cafes. That environment just feels nicer.
Yeah, it's so interesting because like I think San Francisco has some really amazing cafes in that area. But like Singapore doesn't. Singapore is such a high, everything is so expensive. It's the world's most expensive car market. It's the world's most expensive everything market. And so cafes are these like, you go in, you spend $10 on a chai latte or something. It's like implicit that you're only supposed to stay for an hour. It's like very restaurant vibes, even though it's a cafe. Yeah. And like, I guess you can go to a Starbucks or a Coffee Bean or like these like chain places, but you know, it's not the same like local touch. And also like places like Starbucks, the seats, they're like stool seats. And so it's kind of meant for you not to stay in these places. Like even in Chapel Hill or in Toronto, like there's some really nice cafes that I like really like working out of, and I miss the ambiance. But as a result, like right now I'm in KL, Kuala Lumpur, in Malaysia, buying a WeWork membership, and so it's like a whole thing. This is actually Naveed's idea, so I'm gonna go to WeWork after this. But love WeWork, big fan.
It's totally worth it, especially if you travel a lot because you can just go to WeWork in all the
places. There's like WeWorks all over the place. I mean, less so in like quirky rural Asian areas, which I also want to go to, but like Bangkok and Manila and Jakarta and like Singapore and Malaysia. Like there's so many different options, and that's really exciting.
That's super interesting. I definitely feel like cafes are also a very North American thing, and I think I just
in European
something I've recently realized in European
but in Europe it's not like you don't bring your laptop to a cafe. Like it's cafe in the culture. Like in Serbia you drink coffee at least 3 times a day. It's the same thing in Scandinavia. It's a fika. Absolutely. Like, there's totally a caffeine problem in that country. Like I grew up, my parents like wake up, they have a coffee, breakfast, then they have another espresso, and then they have lunch, and then espresso, and then it's like a whole thing. But it's kind of like it's this social aspect of there's certain hours of the day where everyone is just on the streets drinking coffee, talking to each other. Is that productive? I don't think so. Like in terms of like work productivity output, but like does it make them happier? I think so. Like I think it's kind of this like small little mundane connections like that really just boosts people's happiness.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think cafes try to emulate that sort of environment as well. I think it's so much more serendipitous. The amount of people I just run into in cafes, or like the amount of friends I've made from being in a cafe and just having a conversation about something we see. It's just, I think it's a great way to also meet people. But again, it's very much just like the way they've designed the spaces. I think in a lot of Asian cities, they design them for people to come in and leave. Like it's they make the seats, they design the tables that way so that you just can't stay long.
Well, come to think about it, cafes in North America are kind of like a combination of, it's kind of like a reflection on the North American values of social dynamic. It's like work meets socialization. Like I was talking to Adam yesterday, and like you go to a party in San Francisco and it's like, oh, what do you do for a living? And there's like kind of this thing, you're always obsessed with like what people do. Identity is a huge thing in the continent, where it's like less so of a thing in Asia and Europe. I think people latch on, and it's like also a consumer thing. Like people latch on to what they have, who they are, what's in their bio, and like what they do is kind of a reflection of who they are. Whereas in a lot of parts of the world, what you do is just how you make a living and like who you are. Like you're not, you know, you're not a programmer, you're not a marketer, you are a mother and you like knitting and you enjoy trips to the Alps. Like there's other things that define you, whereas in North America, it's like, no, like, I'm an entrepreneur, mm-hmm. and I'm a computer scientist, and I'm a scientist, and I'm all these things. And then, like, that's kind of how you see our social institutions, like cafes, like, they're reflected upon those things.
Yeah.
Anyway.
There's something about labels that is very comforting. Something sustainable, being able to say, this is what I, you know, definitively contribute to society. I'm a computer scientist. I can write code. I can do this. Whereas I feel like in a lot of these other cultures, like you said, it's very much just like who you are, right? I'm a mother. I'm also a sister. I'm also all of these other things.
Yeah.
And so I think there's a fusion of those two that we need. And that's another big kind of realization I've had is being in an environment like the Bay Area or New York or a lot of these higher tech cities is really nice because you're around people who are very driven and have this agency. But it's also nice to step away from that and be like, wait a minute, yeah. We are in a bubble. And that's something I've come to realize often is sometimes I'll just step back and I'll be like, the fact that we're even having these conversations is like, we are definitely in a bubble. And it helps to really have that there to ground you, but also to think about other parts of the world. Like, how are people living? What are things that other people care about? And so I do think there's like a balance between those two that we need. Yeah.
Yeah. One of the most valuable assets I think we have is our memories and our curiosity. So in that, you can read a book. So even if you've never been to the developing world, you can read a book about it. And if you remember what that book says about these life experiences, and you can compare that to your life in different moments, like, you'll experience lots and lots of gratitude. And I think you really get to put into like your struggles into perspective. And I think also realizing, like, when you choose a certain scenario, like, okay, you might be taking a really hard class and you might be like banging your head against the wall for the exam, but you still chose that class. Like, you chose that education, like, you chose all those things. And as much as they might be difficult and the professor might not be like helping you in a certain way, there's like millions of girls who would give everything they could ever have to switch our positions, to have like the opportunities that we have. And I think that we really, really, really often forget that, and we don't use our memories as an asset to guide ourselves through the world. I don't know if you would agree, or if you have any, I'm curious if you have like any tools of thought that really help you push through really hard times.
Yeah, I think definitely gratitude is honestly the biggest one. I think huge realization I've had lately is the difference between when I'm really happy versus when I'm not feeling as great. It's all internal. It's all just like a mindset. Because when I look at my external environment, nothing has really changed. But I'm like, why do I feel different about this situation? And it's your mindset and the way that you have started to frame things. And I think there's like a few things there. I think one of them is like a byproduct of your environment. One thing that I often find is like when everyone around you is very stressed and they're always, oh my God, you know, this midterm, these grades, blah, blah, blah. You almost feel like you should be stressed, even though like you're not, but you're like, I feel like I should also be stressed. But I think being able to detach myself from those things is something that helped me a lot. And I think that's one of the benefits of taking a gap year and coming into college with a different perspective. I knew a lot of these things that we might be worrying about in the short term don't actually matter if we just like zoom out. And that's something I try to do a lot too, is I literally have like in my mind, it's like a visual, like it's like a picture of the globe. I'm like, this thing matters a lot right now. It's like zoomed into a very specific place. But if I zoom out, I just look at the globe. It's like not going to matter in the grand scheme of things. Everything will be okay. And so that helps a lot, just looking at your overall trajectory, like comparing yourself to your past self versus comparing yourself to other people in your environment. Because I think a lot of that stress is just from comparison. It's, oh, this person got better grades than me, or feeling imposter syndrome because they're better at this thing that you might have to, you know, work a little bit harder at. But it's just realizing that like doesn't matter in the long term. That plus gratitude, something I try to do is just, I don't do it that often, but when I'm not feeling good, I'll just literally pull out my notes app and I'll just be like, what am I actually looking forward to? And then I'll just start writing down, even if it's like a small thing. Like I'm seeing my friend later today and they make me happy. I'm like, I'm looking forward to that. And I think that just reminds you of the little things that you have that you take for granted oftentimes. And it's sad that our brains work that way sometimes. We have to be reminded of worse situations to realize that we're in a good situation. So I try to avoid that too, because I think it's just something that eventually you just have to know that you're in a privileged position, which we already are. The fact that we're even educated and are doing all these things, like we are already very privileged. So I try to remind myself of that.
Yeah, I totally agree. I'm curious now, sort of shifting gears a little bit, and I know we're sort of running a little bit low on time, but what about current news. How do you balance current news? And Adam and I were talking yesterday about like the idea of an information diet and how like there's good things that you can eat and there's bad things and you can eat them in moderation, et cetera, et cetera. And I think news has always been this thing that you can really latch onto it and it can kind of become your personality, like read the news every day and be aware of all these global political things. But you don't really have that much control. Like you could have known about Silicon Valley Bank 2 weeks before it happened. You don't really have that much control, you know, and maybe you can like take out your money or something like that. Like those are very insightful things. But I'm curious like how you think about adding news, staying on top of the news when things are really changing and what information that you really pay attention to and how that kind of informs the rest of like, your daily life. And you can even talk about social media too. I think that's like a form of information. It might not be like newsworthy, but it's still information.
Yeah. I mean, social media is huge. If you think about it, a lot of your thoughts are shaped by social media. Like Twitter is one great example of that where you're spending. I think it's also very easy to get sucked into Twitter and just hear all of the same things over and over again and start to just believe that that's what's true, even though it might not be. It's just people being impulsive or being scared or living off of the fear of things that are happening. I mean, SVB is like an example of that. Obviously, it was like a very hard situation and people were fearful for the right reasons, but a lot of a lot of stuff was very exaggerated because of the fact that it was shared online or was shared before someone else shared it. The timelines were just very different and certain people had access to information, other people didn't. So I think there's a lot of those like dynamics that are often at play when you're hearing the news. I think one thing that helps me is honestly just doing it, like looking at the news. It can be very overwhelming because there's just so much happening. I feel like every day there's something new to learn about. And I often feel like I always have this backlog of just things that I want to dive deeper into and just get smarter about and learn more about. But it's like you might not have the time and that makes you feel kind of overwhelmed. But I think for me, it's just doing it in pieces. So really just setting like a limit, whether it be on social media or even with the content I'm consuming. And I think one way you can limit is just limit the people you follow. This is something that I did recently, which helped a lot. I think social media or Twitter, just following certain people, I think is really valuable. But if you follow just everyone, people whose thoughts you don't really align with or people who are just saying things for the sake of saying it. The other piece is just taking breaks, really. I know it's like a cliche thing, but it helps a lot. I try to just, at least once a week, I just try not to go on social media. It should be more often, but at least once a week, I try to take a break. You can just kind of detach and also live in the moment more so. But yeah, I think just filtering for content, and that's something that happens over time, right? Like I think when you first start reading the news, you kind of read everything and you believe everyone's perspectives. And then as you start to talk to more people, you become more informed about what information is good, what information is not good. It's good to have different perspectives, but at some point I think you do develop a flavor for what types of things you're more interested in learning about or following than others. And at that point, I think you should just completely filter and just curate your feed, because you'd be shocked at how much the content you look at, even if it's just a simple tweet, that is unconsciously actually shaping the way you think about things. And that's how I think about it. It's like everything I look at, that's like me choosing to spend time on that. So is it worth doing that?
Yeah, I think there's actually one trigger that I found really important recently, which is that I'm on Instagram and I want to click on someone's story. Why? What comes into my head? Oh, I want to compare myself to this person, or I want to see what they're up to, but like in a malicious way. Like if I saw your Instagram story, I'd be like, oh my God, like I want to see what she's up to. Like I'm so excited. But there's some people where I'm like, oh my God, like I'm actually subconsciously, like it's almost negative to myself and I'm seeing it in that way. Come to think about it, you kind of have this moment, okay, angel on your shoulder, like you should unfollow them because this is not the type of person you want to be. Devil on your shoulder is like, but if you unfollow them, then you have to request back again, like you won't actually get to see all these things. And I think it's like really important to see those micro decisions as a reflection of the person you are going to be. Because okay, you choose to continue following this person that you are like constantly comparing yourself to and like using it as a way of lowering your self-esteem, that will compound. Sure, it won't have an effect tomorrow, but that could have an effect in 5 years. And each step that you take to move away from that, like you will become a better version of yourself. And I think that's something that reflecting on what triggers in your brain and like what the good side of you was saying and then what the bad side of you was saying and kind of making a decision there.
And I think it's totally okay to almost, I think it's okay to be a little bit selfish there. Like something that I've been doing recently is like, if I'm just not close with someone, but I'm seeing their content, it's just not making me feel that great. Or I feel like I'm comparing myself.
Yeah.
I'll just unfollow or I'll mute. Like, I don't see that. I don't, you know, I think you should almost be a little bit selfish in that way because that's the content that you're seeing. And if it's something that you don't align with or something that makes you feel uncomfortable, that's okay.
Yeah, it's like you can't people please for your entire life. It's not worth like the energy. Like I've seen too many people who just commit to pleasing just for the sake of pleasing. I think that's just unhealthy and detrimental to who you are and the impact you could have. I think that's like the core element there.
Yeah, totally.
Okay, why don't we end off on a TKS reflective note? Because one thing I'm very jealous of in San Francisco is that there's so many TKS people. There's just a really great culture down there. And so I want to know how you're sort of leveraging the community there, but also if there's any nostalgia that you have from TKS been coming up lately, like maybe like a mindset you're reflecting on, like a piece of gratitude. I mean, your AI focus kind of seemed big start to all of the work that you're doing now. So I'm curious on the community and then like any pieces of nostalgia you want to share.
Yeah, community's been great. I think there's definitely, even this past weekend, I was in SF and I met up with a bunch of alumni, like Hannah, Jay, Adam. I saw Adam too at like an event. Yeah. So it was really nice. I think it was just, I've also lived in SF before. So even outside of TKS, there's definitely a community that I've formed, which is why I really wanted to like be in the Bay Area. Because these are all like really smart people that I look up to in terms of just the work they're doing or how driven they are. And so I think it's nice to be close to that environment. I think SF is just known for like events. I think events are a great way to meet people. Mm-hmm. There's a lot of serendipity that happens because geographically, I think it's very spread out. And then, yeah, I think in terms of like nostalgia or just like takeaways that I've been thinking a lot about, I'd say the biggest one is really just how to not let your environment influence you too much. I think having a framework for why you do things is really helpful. I think especially when people around you might not have the same values as you or might not think about things in the same way, it's easy to feel like you should assimilate to that or you should change the way you think about things to fit into that mold. I feel like as humans, we're just naturally people pleasers. We want to fit in. We don't want to like stand out and be different. But that's something I'm trying to embrace. It's okay if I think about things differently or have a different viewpoint on life. And how can I just really tap into that? If I have different interests than other freshmen, that's okay. How can I really leverage that and start building depth into that early on? So I think that's probably the biggest mindset is really the overall takeaway of the values you develop and how you should stick to them over time. Be flexible to them changing, obviously, because we're still young, we're still growing. There's things we're learning that we didn't know when we were like 15 and we started doing this. But I think a lot of those core values really stick with me in terms of just how to approach things in life and not getting like too influenced by your environment too.
Yeah. Okay. What an amazing note to end on. Also, I can't believe we're both turning 20 in a couple of months. That's ridiculous. But yeah, this is, I think it's such a nice note to like maybe continue on into the week and just take over the world a little bit with these great mindsets. So thanks so much, Alishba. Thanks for catching up with us. That was Making It Real by TKS, and I'm your host, Isabella. I hope you have a crazy audacious week, and I will see you next time.